I, together with Megumi Harada and Lisa Jeffrey and Alistair Savage, thank you for coming to our workshop and welcome you to Toronto if you're not from here, and the Fields Institute. So I want to just give sort of a hot air sort of talk about Schubert calculus and what it's about. And instead of saying everything that I want to say, I think I'll just yeah, it's pretty busy. It's a pretty busy board, but it will actually stay up during the whole talk. And it's at least, I mean, I don't really take it too seriously in terms of that these are the connections that one should think about, or that these are the only connections, or that there aren't arrows going from one bubble to the other that should be or shouldn't be. But it just gives an indication of some of the relations, at least in my mind, between the two main components of the title of this workshop, Schubert calculus and Schubert varieties. And so I think, if I can, let me try to just draw your attention to the following kind of fact, that the relations in this include algebraic geometry, representation theory, combinatorics, symplectic geometry, and various cohomology theories. So let me just be more inclusive and say algebra. And the reason why I want to put this out right at the beginning is because you might wonder, well, I mean, what's this Schubert business all about? What's it like, you know, how general is the business? And I want to say that these five aspects, these five areas of mathematics are connected in fairly serious and important ways, and they're not just tangential connections. Some of the, for example, the connection between the Schubert varieties and representations of complex semisimple Lie groups is, you know, very very fundamental through these famous theorems of Borel, Veit, Bott, and de Mazur, and then questions of Cash and Lustig polynomials, which you may have encountered from various points of view, are very much in a serious way about smoothness of Schubert varieties. And on the other hand, well, I don't know how many people from the string, you might know that right now there's a year-long program on string theory, and you might wonder, well, is there really any relations between Schubert calculus and string theory? And certainly, the flow, you'll notice that there's this back and forth flow between the bubble with MGN bar of something and Schubert calculus, and certainly ideas from moduli space of moduli spaces and string theory have influenced Schubert calculus through quantum cohomology and given interesting problems. But on the other hand, Schubert varieties and Schubert calculus together provide are a setting from which one can actually do mere symmetry verifications. So I'll leave that board up, just and you'll notice in the orange there are some sort of they're intended to be icons of at least some of these pictures, so that if you can't read it, you might be able to at least see, yeah, I sort of know what that picture is, and that's supposed to remind me of something. So one of the intents of this workshop is to really try, we hope that if you are an expert in one or more of these areas, you will help us learn how to perhaps understand one of the bubbles in relation to others and perhaps develop other connections. And there are many interesting open problems that still exist, and basic ones as well. So let me just sort of begin with some. Well, at least in my mind, some of those dotted lines refer to the fact that we don't completely understand the relations between the two bubbles, and perhaps relate to some of the main open problems that arise in the field. Like perhaps, really, maybe I should have put a dotted line between here, in the sense that one knows what Cash-Linguistic polynomials have to do with smoothness, but there are some problems with Cash-Linguistic polynomials that are quite famous and relate to completely understanding smoothness of Schubert varieties, which we don't understand yet. I mean, we understand why that's the problem, we don't understand how to solve it. And the same could be said about each of the other dotted lines that I've drawn up there. And probably I could really fairly make at least partially dotted lines in a bunch of other places. So it's very very much incomplete and incorrect, but the best that I can do. So I just wanted to start with some comments about classical enumerative geometry, just to set the stage for what the classical motivations of this business is. So, of course, algebraic geometry is about understanding solutions to systems of polynomial equations. So, one of the basic questions you can ask is, how many points are there in the intersection of a collection of hypersurfaces? And perhaps let's work over, naively over R. So this corresponds, of course, to a collection of hypersurfaces. So I'm assuming these perhaps homogeneous polynomials. So sort of the basic question in algebraic geometry that one studies. And so the answer, due to Bazou, is the answer is at most the product of the degrees of the polynomials. So this inequality is, you know, in mathematics, I heard a lecture last week by Eric Zaslow, and he said that mathematics is about equality, A equals B. So from that point of view, he and I should agree that this inequality is undesirable. And so I suppose I would like an equality. So how can you fix that? How can you try to get an equality here? And well, there's at least a couple ways you can fix this. You can say, and I think we all sort of know this, and I'll come back to this issue. I can perhaps replace R by the complex numbers, and so allow for non-real solutions. That looks like a fairly standard thing nowadays to do. And well, we may want to replace Cn with a projective space and allow for asymptotic solutions. So two lines, perhaps, or point at infinity. Another issue that comes up even in high school is the question of multiplicity of a solution. So what if you have a double root, right? How do you want to count that as one or two? And so we think of it as being two. So how do you handle this in this greater generality? How do you deal with multiplicity of a solution, so that this inequality becomes an equality? Well, here's how here's how the classical geometers would have dealt with it. So let's suppose we want to understand a point in the intersection. Then we want to find an intersection multiplicity, I of P, which will denote I of P, well, sorry, I of P of the intersection. And it's going to be 1 if it's a transverse intersection. And, of course, it's going to be greater than equal to 1 otherwise. So it's this greater than equal to 1 otherwise that I want to complain about. So what's the idea to fix that? And this is the Poincaré's principle of continuity. The idea is to think of not your fixed hypersurface H1 to HN, but rather a family of hypersurfaces, and let them move so that the intersections do become transverse, and then claim that that should be the intersection multiplicity. So you want to vary HI of T. So now a hypersurface that depends on an extra parameter T that has the property that it converges or limits to your ith hypersurface as T goes to 0. And then you want to then take generically, well, okay, how do I want to say this? I want to say that perhaps maybe at T equals 1, let's just try that. At T equals 1, you want to say that you want to set it up so that this family intersects transversely. So whereas previously you had some double intersection, somehow you move it so that maybe the right picture here. I guess you want to have, you can move it so that you have, make the intersection 1 plus 1 equals 2. And then, so then you have two points of intersection. So whereas previously you had this P, now you have a P1 of 1 and a P2 of 1. And then you just say that the I of P, and which with the property that you want P1 of T to converge to PI, your ith intersection point. And then you just say that the, or rather to just your P, and then you just want to say that your intersection is going to be the sum of those. The number of PIs in your generic transverse intersection. So this is the principle of continuity. And so let me then just say what's the principle that we can derive from this situation. So the principle is that first you want to work on a compact parameter space. Well, you at least want a compact space. In this case, that space is CPN. And you want a moving lemma. In this case, the principle of continuity that puts things into sort of general position and then allows you to answer the question in the general case. So whereas we might be confused about what it really means for this to have multiplicity 2, we say, well, let's perturb the solution a little bit and then answer it there and then say that by continuity, the answers are the same. So this 1 plus 1 equals 2. So that's Bazou's theorem, and it's completely justifiable. So now I want to go to the classic problem of Schubert calculus, the four lines problem. And it's the basic problem, although people are sort of debating about what's the basic problem of. And I think that's a fair question. So this is a basic Schubert calculus question. But basic for what? And I think as the week goes through and we listen to some of the lectures from my colleagues here, you should ask this question if you haven't seen it before. What is the four lines problem in a quantum setting, or perhaps a K-theory setting, or any of the other settings that arise, or equivariant cohomology setting? So here's the question, and I apologize for some of you who have seen this many times, but let me ask, how many lines intersect four given generic lines? So generic or random lines in CP3. So really, if you don't want to think about CP3, you can think about RP3. And if you don't want to really think about this projective space, you can just ask the question R3. Right? So let's draw this picture. So here's four generic lines. So they don't have any unexpected linear dependencies. So maybe you have random 1, random 2, random 3, and random 4. And you want to ask how many orange lines intersect all four of these lines at the same time. And so, depending on your visual dexterity, I mean, it may not be obvious that there's a finite number or what the answer should be, or it may not be obvious that the answer is really well-defined. Maybe depending on the relative positions of the lines, one can get different answers. So, and in particular, what does it really mean to be random? Well, I think we can more or less settle on that. But all these questions are very fair questions. And in any case, I mean, even if you could figure out the answer and you have enough dexterity to justify in your mind that there's a specific answer and you can tell me what it is, then you would like some sort of calculus to be able to determine this. And this is really what is meant by Schubert calculus, that the classical geometers in the 19th century came up with specific methods that turned these problems into routine questions. Unfortunately, their methods weren't 100% justified. So let me just sketch out the way in which they would do this. They'd say, well, let's follow this principle, and we want to have some sort of moving lemma. And we'll say, well, let's move R1, R2 until they actually touch one another. Right? And then move R3 and R4 until they touch one another, like the principle of continuity in action. And then the answer is obvious. The answer is obviously there's one line that passes through these intersection points. And then These two planes that are defined by R1, R2, and R3, and R4, well, they have a point of intersection too. So the answer is 2, right, in this specific specialized situation of the problem. So what's wrong with this? They're actually claiming that in any four random lines generically placed, you can do the specialization, and the answer doesn't change. This is precisely where one starts wondering, why shouldn't it change? What justification do you have for that claim? And whereas they did have a reasonable justification for this, in general, there are many problems like this, and we'll come back to this at the end of the lecture, where it wasn't known why such degenerations should be valid and maintain the answer. And they also, and oftentimes there were just wrong solutions using this sort of methodology. So the modern approach to this is via intersection theory. And so now let me sort of tell you in sort of grand sketches what the sort of terminology, or rather, not terminology, some of the icons of what gets thrown around now very in a very standard way that would give answers to this. And in every case, there are reasonable and interesting questions that arise. Maintain that, and let me go here. Oh, actually, let me erase this. So, following the principle stated there, we have to look for a compact space to work on. And here, our compact space is going to be the space of lines in CP3, which is really the Grassmannian of two planes in C4. So the Grassmannian of two planes C4 is the space where every point is a two-dimensional subspace of complex four-dimensional space. And so now I'm going to just write down some completely nonsense, you can think of it as convention notation, and then I'll do some specific calculations with specific ways to calculate it. Okay, so this is just stuff. So this is a flag variety, or a particular case of a flag variety. And I will not define a Schubert variety in this lecture. I am pleased to leave that to Megumi. But let me talk about the variety Xi being the subvariety of lines that meet the ith random line. So you're now working in the space of lines in CP3, right? Because these are all, so each of these lines is now a point in that space, or you can think of it as a point in the Grassmannian, and now you're looking at the subvariety of all lines that meet a specific line. While the Grassmannian is indeed compact, so this variety gives rise to a Poincaré dual. In the cohomology of the Grassmannian of 2 and 4. So if you don't know what that means, then you can look forward to a lecture by Alistair where he'll explain exactly what this is supposed to be about. So where's our moving lemma, one that's actually justifiable? Well, certainly, I mean, because these are all random, we can move any one of these lines to any other line by continuous deformation. Like, that part is perfectly reasonable. So by continuous deformation, we can move any xi to any xj, so we might as well think of these classes x1 as being equal to x2, as being equal to x3, as being equal to x4 in the cohomology ring. And so the answer, and this is again, notational, is going to be some integral of this intersection. So, again, this is the points in x1 and the points in x2 and the points in x3 and the points in x4 are exactly the points that meet r1, r2, r3, and r4, and we're computing this integral, and of course this is being, all of them being the same, or rather because we can assume a transverse intersection of these varieties, you can take this product, and the point being here, the only thing I want you to remember here is that you want to now take a product. This intersection is now a product in this notation. And because, as we said, they're all the same, then this is really a product of the same class, x1, or well, we might as well just call x now because they're all the same, to the fourth. Well, maybe x. I will just say x1 just to be specific. So this problem becomes really a question about multiplying classes inside the cohomology ring of a Grassmannian. So it becomes a question of, if you like, commutative algebra. If you understood complete presentation of this ring, then, and you understood how to represent each of these classes inside a ring, then you just need to multiply those classes and extract some answer. So why doesn't that just solve Schubert calculus, and why is there anything left to do? So let's actually do that, exactly that process. And so now I'm going to give a very baby calculation that will be explained by Nantel Bergeron, and I won't justify any of these calculations, so I won't steal from him, but I'll just show you the flavor of the kind of calculation that one can do, and which does answer the question, but perhaps not in the way that we find most satisfactory, and I'll explain why. So the conclusion is, get a ring presentation of this cohomology ring, and there are ways to do that, and then it's all just computer algebra, maybe. So what sort of beast are we talking about? Well, the calculation in question we're going to work in the following, we're going to really do the following calculation. x1, the variable x1 plus x2 to the fourth, and we want to calculate in the following ring. And so I'm doing a little bit of cheating here, but not really that bad. Generated by h1, h2, h3, h4, where this is the hi is the ith homogeneous symmetric function. So hi is equal to the sum over all degree I monomials in the variables x1 to x4. All right, so now we can, if you want, once you know this, you can just forget everything I said before and just ask this question. And so, I mean, I'll be more specific. Let's just calculate this. So what you could do is you could compute a Grobner base, I mean, you don't need to, but in computer algebra world, we would say, let's try to compute a Grobner basis of h1 to h4, and one could deduce the following relations. That x4 is equal to negative of x1 plus x2 plus x3. x3 squared is equal to negative of x1 squared plus x1, x2 plus x1, x3 plus x2 squared plus x2, x3. x2 cubed is equal to negative x1 cubed plus x1 squared x2 plus x1 x2 squared. And you may want an exercise of what the general pattern here is for when you place n a 4 with n. And x1 to the 4th is 0. So let's just do the expansion and see what this sort of computational methodology gets you. So we want to reduce modulo these relations so that you can't use these relations anymore. So let me just do a few steps with the calculation so you get an idea. So it's x1 to the 4th plus right? But then this is still reducible using these relations. In particular, we can express this, well, this x1 to the 4th goes to 0, and so this is equal to x4 x1 cubed x2, because there's nothing we can do there, plus 6x1 squared x2 squared, right? And then minus 4x1 x1 cubed plus x1 squared x2 plus x1 x2 squared, right? Because it's x to the cube, you can make a reduction. Minus, and then this can reduce, so minus x2 times x1 cubed plus x1 squared x2 plus x1 x2 squared. So this is what your computer would do. It says x to the fourth. Well, it's really x2 times x2 cubed, and x2 cubed is this thing here. So let's do that calculation. So this is, you can check, negative x1 cubed x2 plus x1 squared x2 squared minus x1 x2 cubed, which you can reduce again, is equal to negative x1, I'm almost there, x2 plus x1 squared x2 squared plus x1, and you can reduce this x2 cubed by replacing this thing. And finally, this becomes 2 times x1 squared x2 squared. And Nantel will explain why this is the calculation one wants to get, and this is the 2 from the four lines problem. You know, that wasn't so bad, and computer could do it, you know, could do it very fast. You know, why isn't that just the end of the story? Well, here's a simple point that maybe you might think should be addressed, or maybe you don't think should be addressed, and I'll try to convince you otherwise. Even though this answer is a positive integer, there's no way you would be able to determine that from these calculations. I mean, people have tried. You might think, oh, Romner bases are reasonably nice combinatorial-like objects, so one might hope that by using a Romner basis, one can turn all these calculations and see the positivity as you do the calculations. But no way. I mean, you got negative signs all over the place. You know, you could not possibly, I mean, if you were just a computer and you just saw these calculations beforehand, you would have no reason to believe that you would see this too. A positive integer at the end. It could have been negative 5. Why positive 2? And so you might ask, well, who cares? Who really cares about this oddity? And I mean, I think that the answer to that question is that because these numbers appear in so many different places, these Schubert structure constants, not only to this seemingly kind of this four lines problem, but rather to its many generalizations, which will be discussed by many of the participants this week, we would like to understand these numbers as well as possible. And as well as possible to us, at least if we look to our friends in representation theory, where they consider tensor product multiplicity questions, usually means a positive combinatorial counting answer. And in general, no such answers exist. I mean, there are special cases where one knows this, but we'd like a nice combinatorial answer to the question, to this question and its generalities. You would like to say 2 is equal to the number of ways to drop balls in boxes, red balls and blue balls, in some sort of order. So now let me then use that to explain what we do know and its relations. So this is now going up to that top circle up there, positive combinatorics of generalized Schur polynomials. And so let me tell you the archetypical situation where we do know how to calculate this positively, and I will recalculate this too in a different way. So the point is that we would like a manifestly positive method to solve this. Manifestly positive. And by this I mean combinatorial. Although there are many ways to get this answer, and we'd like, in general, let me be less strong than this. We would just like to understand these numbers as well as possible. Positively or even negatively, but we would just like to understand these numbers. But just to crystallize it, let me just say we would like manifestly positive combinatorial solutions to these questions, to questions like this. So by questions like this, I mean intersections of Schubert varieties, whatever that means. So, without getting into the details, let me give you a general framework from which this question is a special case. So to every, and I'm not going to define any of this, just to give you the notation to relate it to Schur polynomials, the Grassmannian of K-planes in Cn, I want to, just for combinatorial purposes, think of as being a rectangle of height k and width n minus k. And those xi spaces of varieties are now going to be replaced by x lambda, a generalization, and the lambda is a partition contained inside this box. So if you've seen this this business before, that's great, but still I have a question for you. I still have a question for you nonetheless. So all this stuff, this Poincaré dual stuff, goes through, and we have a Schubert class, sigma lambda, in the cohomology of this Grassmannian. And so the question that's being asked is to multiply two of these Schubert classes and expand. This forms an additive basis. This will be all explained by Alistair. And because it forms a basis, a linear basis, you can again expand terms of this basis, and you'll get some numbers. And these nu's are, by definition, contained inside this k times n minus k box. Okay. Because that's what these partitions are. The partitions we care about are the ones contained inside this box. So the C lambda, mu lambda nu, is called the literal Richardson coefficient. And it is a positive integer. And so what's so interesting about it? Well, one of the oddities of this whole business, and which I think really kind of suggests there's something more that we want to understand, is that even in this case, where we do know beautiful formulas, one of which I'll show you, just to give you a sense of what the combinatorics we dream would look like, is that this is the same coefficient that appears over here, tensor product multiplicities of GLN irreps. Very strange thing. It's not, there's no complete justification or explanation of why something about intersecting, these linear algebra-like defined spaces should have anything to do with representation theory. And people have thought reasonably hard. So that is considered one of the interesting puzzles of this business, to give an explanation. And because really I think that this is not, well, depending on who you talk to, either this is an oddity of type A, or there's something more, and it's something we need to understand. So let me show you, and of course this little Richardson coefficient comes up in other settings as well, multiplying two Schur polynomials together if you're an algebraic combinatorialist, and expanding in the basis of Schur polynomials, that's the number that you get. There are proofs of this coincidence, but they're all algebraic. They don't really answer why why it happens. You would like some sort of, say, you have some intersection and then you convert it into an invariant vector in some natural way. And everything that exists so far is saying that, well, they go through symmetric polynomials. You just show that Schubert calculus is controlled by the algebraic combinatorics of Schur polynomials, and you show that these GLN irreps, tensor product multiplicities, are controlled by the same thing, and so therefore these numbers must be the same. So here's a nice solution to calculating these numbers. And I'm pleased to say nice because it's not anything that I've come up with. And there are many ways to do this, but I wanted to show you this one because I have a question about it that I want to ask you. It's due to Knudsen Tau. So the way in which you can calculate these numbers is you take your partition lambda, and you don't think of it as a partition. You think of it as a lattice path starting from here and ending here, and you put zeros and ones, zero for every horizontal bar, one for every vertical bar, and you obtain a 0-1 sequence. Okay, and you do that for mu, and you do that for nu. And then you draw triangles, equilateral triangles like this one, and you put your 0-1 sequence lambda here, your 0-1 sequence lambda mu here, and then you put the new sequence down here. The game is to do the following. You have the following three puzzle pieces. This unit 1 equilateral triangle, whose borders are all zeros. This equilateral triangle, its borders all 1. And a union of two triangles, a rhombus, whose border is like that. Okay. So you can rotate any of the pieces, but you cannot flip this piece. So you can rotate, but don't flip. And I'll do a short example. And the game is to, once you fix the border, so maybe 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, and then, I don't know, maybe I'll think of multiplying it by itself. Oh, have I? Okay. Combinatorics. Okay. So, in any case, I won't fill the puzzle to be able to embarrass myself for not knowing exactly the rule. But the point is that you fill this, and then you get, you try to fill as much as possible until you get to the bottom. This gets filled, blah, blah, blah. And then you're going to get some 0-1 sequence. If you get nu, then you're happy. So, and if you don't get nu, you're sad. So C lambda mu nu is equal to the number of puzzle fillings of this. I trust my friend Leonardo because he knows all about these things. So so you want to fill these with these puzzles until you get the borders being lambda, mu, and nu. And that's the answer. And it's a beautiful answer. I mean, you can state it very simply, and it has wonderful properties that you can think about, and has been useful in various ways, and I'll talk about them as we go along. So here's the question I just like to ask. It's a question that's derived from a question of Fulton's. And I think it's interesting. And one can state this in terms of Schur polynomials if one likes, but let me ask it to you. Characterize the pairs lambda and mu, right? So we're fix the Grassmannian, fix the Grassmannian of k planes and Cn. So in other words, fix a rectangle. And so we're taking partitions lambda and mu inside the rectangle. So characterize the pairs lambda and mu such that C lambda mu nu, well, or in other words, the number of puzzles with boundaries lambda mu and nu is always in 0 or 1 for all nu. In other words, if you multiply two Schur polynomials and you expand in terms of the Schur basis, you want to know multiplicity-free expansions, the characterization of when this number is always 0 or 1. Well, let me do exactly that. He did not quite. So what he would have done in terms of Schur polynomials, he expanded a product of two Schur polynomials and did not put this funny restriction of nu must be contained inside k times n minus k. So that's basically the same question in terms of representation theory. But we want this question, which is to impose this condition, which makes it a Schubert calculus question. I think one of the reasons why we care is that it has some similarities to saturation, the saturation theorem. And so let me just talk about that for a moment, because it was a nice one of the nice contributions in recent years to this business, and in fact was answered by using puzzles or variations thereof. So let's talk about Horn's problem. So this is a question that seemingly has nothing to do with Schubert calculus at all. Take Hermitian complex matrices that satisfy n by n matrices, Hermitian complex, such that A plus B equals C. And so these have eigenvalues that you can rearrange to be a partition. Say the alpha, beta, and gamma are eigenvalue lists. Can you characterize the eigenvalues that can appear? Or right. So nothing. I mean, partitions appear, but other than that, what does this have to do with Schubert calculus? Doesn't look like anything. And Horn came up. I mean, if you think about it a little bit, you can come up with some obvious identities. Like, for example, you can figure out that the trace of A plus the trace of B equals the trace of C, and that gives you some conditions. And then if you think harder, you'll get more interesting ones. And Horn actually came up with a complete list of a conjectural complete list of all conditions that alpha, beta, and gamma must satisfy. But it was conjecture for, I think, maybe almost 40 years. Surprisingly, the solution, as due to work of Kaliachko and Zelovinsky, and I think Fulton also made contributions. This corresponds to the following question: is it true that C lambda mu nu is not equal to zero if and only if the scaling is not zero? This is the saturation problem. So by n lambda, I mean you multiply every row by length n. And the answer is yes.
That's this work of Knudsen and Tao.
And in fact, together with
Chris Woodward,
they showed that not only is this true and therefore this horn problem is solved, but they actually showed that when C lambda mu nu is equal to 1, then this corresponds exactly to the facets of the polytope that's defined by the various linear inequalities. So this is about the question of when is C lambda mu nu equal to 1 or non-zero, and in the same spirit, we'd like to understand this question, characterizing pairs lambda mu where it's 1. And I think I personally think it's an interesting question and has some reason for it. So let me start wrapping up by mentioning, well, at the beginning of this, we said, well, I suppose we want this inequality to be an inequality. And by doing that, one of the things we had to do was to say, well, let's replace the reals by the complex numbers. But maybe in retrospect, that was just a cheat. Maybe we really want to understand reality. So, right? So, and you could ask this question maybe over the rationals too, maybe even with finite fields. So if you say replace back C with R, how many of those expected complex solutions can you actually get? Can you achieve? So you can ask this in general in algebraic geometry. You can replace any time you have algebraic closed field and just say, well, ask the same enumerative question over R. And so maybe this will just be some ugly, nasty answer that no one can hope to solve. And I think these questions were originally done by Satil, who I believe did the cases of Grassmannians of two planes in CN. And there he showed, back in his thesis, that all of them can be achieved. So even if you replace C by R, you can always achieve all the expected solutions obtained by calculating with this rule. And recently, Vakil established this for all Grassmannians. So? Sort of a question is, to what extent do these results generalize? And at least with this question, you can actually, and people do, think about computing this explicitly and getting ideas. So perhaps you've heard that these sort of problems, like the four lines problems, formed the basis of Hilbert's 15th problem. Hilbert's 15th problem was to... So if we go back to these complaints I made early on, that this sort of moving the four lines so that two of them intersect, that R1 intersects R2 and R3 intersects R4 and stuff like that, seems a little fishy, and then we have to use all this cohomology stuff. Well, now I'm stating things a little bit backwards. This cohomology stuff is really provides the framework from which we say that we've more or less solved Hilbert's 15th problem, which I'll paraphrase. Justify Schubert. So Schubert had a book full of of puzzles like the four-line problem, ones that are in fact quite complex. And he gave many sorts of arguments, like the degeneration argument I explained to you, and said, well, the numbers are, I don't know, 7,776 or maybe 3,264. And they all kind of had specious basis for their answer. And Hilbert did ask this question, and modern intersection theory, which I've given some sketch of, provides probably more or less a complete solution. But I think it's important to note that these sort of enumerative problems are interesting, well, at least in part because of their, in recent years, because of their connection to string theory and all this stuff, but just from classical geometric point of view, any time it seems that you solve one of these problems, solving an enumeration, one of these enumerative geometry problems that hasn't been understood before, I'd like to think gives you better understanding of some moduli space. So with that in mind, let me just mention perhaps the only, well, one of the main open problems back from the 19th century, which hasn't been solved despite the fact that all we know about moduli spaces of curves and things like that. So the following problem is open, and it's due to, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, I think Chasles. It goes back to maybe 1850, around there. Question is, count the number of smooth plane curves of degree D that pass through A given points and B and is tangent to P given general lines. So these are always general in everything I'm saying. And such that A plus B is equal to D times D plus 3 over 2. So this is just to make sure that the answer at least is, I guess, finite. I think that the numbers have been justified up to d equals 4, but in general, no one knows the answer. I just have maybe, well, actually, perhaps 1 minute, I'll just tell you a story that I just recently learned. So a lot of you may know about the Steiner problem. It's like you give five conics and you ask how many plane conics are tangent to five given conics. And so the way in which this gets solved, at least, well, I mean, the original answer to that was 7,776, which is, I think, 6 to the 5th. And I wonder what's 6 to the 5th coming in there. And the reason why is that, well, like the four lines problem, you fix a conic and you ask, what's the condition for conics to be tangent to this conic? And it turns out that it's actually a degree 6 hypersurface in, I think, in CP5. So you say, by Bazou's theorem, you just multiply the degrees of those hypersurfaces together to get the answer of how many conics actually are tangent to each of those five conics, and therefore the answer is this number. But it's wrong because the smooth condition is actually necessary, and you have to worry about the possibility of degenerate answers. So in geometry, call it excess intersection. So this is a double line, for example, which is a degenerate conic. So the person who resolved this was this guy Chasles, and I can't remember exactly the answer, but 3,264, something like that, which is, you know, and he did it by basically developing characteristic numbers from which this problem is still open. So he actually saw through this this naivety. But in his own life, he had a lot of he was a little bit naive himself, and it's quite an amazing story. He was a victim of a fraud. He was a victim of the following fraud. He bought with a lot of money letters from purported to be from Newton and Pascal and others. And in particular, by studying these letters, he discovered that it wasn't Newton who discovered the laws of gravitation at all. It was Pascal. So he went to the French Academy of Sciences and you know, reported on this. And of course, this is controversial, and people wanted to know what's up. And so upon further investigation, they realized the letters were a fraud, and arrested and tried the person who sold them that. So okay, maybe back in time, you might be willing to accept that perhaps, you know, anyone could be fooled by a good forgery. But they went back to his house and looked at some of the other letters he bought, which include letters from Cleopatra and Galileo, all of which were written in French. Well, I hope you enjoy the remainder of the week, and thank you for your attention. There are a bunch of so Harry does give some explanation as to this connection, and he does give some explanation to why you shouldn't expect it in other Lie types in general. But if you look at his proof, he does actually eventually go down to the Pierre's rule. So he at some point exploits algebra. In fact, even a closer answer is given by Beccalli, and Beccalli actually gives an injection from the one side to the other. But to show that, so he gives a geometric map, but to prove it's a surjection, he again uses the fact that the two numbers are the same. Yeah. And somehow less known.